evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
The National Unity Platform should begin with resolving their internal conflicts. The same party could not organize a befitting send-off for their member.
Uganda's governing national resistance movement celebrates 39 years since coming to power.
These are the people that are being called back to Ethiopia to convene and confer and organize and re-energize and strategize to execute whatever plans that they are planning to execute.
Eritrean government critics in the diaspora say they want democratic reforms at home.
Well, first of all, I don't entirely agree that he's not moving fast enough.
And Mozambique's new president, Daniel Chapo, names his cabinet. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Uganda, the governing National Resistance Movement, or NRM, is celebrating 39 years since coming to power in 1986. Led by President Yoweri Museveni, the NRM has become the longest ruling party since Uganda's independence. But opposition members and critics of the administration say Ugandans have nothing to smile about. This after expressing concerns about what they say is the failure of the Museveni government to resolve the challenges facing the country despite repeated promises to do so. They also accuse the administration of using state institutions, including the police and the judiciary, to clamp down on opposition activities. David Kabanda, a member of parliament from the ruling NRM, rejects the accusations as false and without merit. He tells me that Ugandans should rather reject the opposition in the next election because it has been weak and ineffective.
The National Unity Platform should begin with resolving their internal conflicts. The same party could not organize a befitting send-off for their member. They were busy choosing each other of many things. The Mpuga faction held a barrio somewhere. The Chagrin faction held a barrio somewhere. Imagine a political party that wishes to remove another from power is fighting for a dead body. So before they complain about the National Resistance Movement, which celebrated 39 years of existence, they should first of all begin with the issues within their own political party.
Mohamed Katerega, Secretary General of GEMA, is saying the NRM has partially achieved, especially improving roads in Kampala and in other rural areas, and that the NRM has achieved less than 60% of the promises it made over 39 years ago when it came to power.
The Secretary General for GEMA has been a chairman for LC5 for Bukomansimbi District, where we have constructed a very good tarmac road from Villa Maria up to Zimbabwe. It goes up to Gomba. So really, we have given the people of Bukomansimbi gave him a mandate to manage a district, but he ran away. He could not even work on a few kilometers which are in his district with a huge budget from the central government, and is busy criticizing the NRM government, which is managing the entire country, and whose budget has just been increased, not even in 5 years. So some of those people are not fair, and they are not genuine. But we leave them. I know they don't know much.
Jimmy Akena, the MP and UPC president, said there are a lot of wasted opportunities, and then the NRM keep referring to 1986 as if there were no developments in Uganda before then. You have alluded to that. How do you respond to him?
The Honorable Jema Akemna should first of all begin with blaming his wife, because his wife is a minister in the cabinet. Whatever decision is brought to parliament has to be decided on by the cabinet, where his wife is a minister. Has he received reports from his own wife, Honorable Betty Amongi, the Minister of State for Gender, that the government of Uganda has failed to perform in his own region, his own constituents? The government of Uganda has worked on various roads, including a new road that we are working on called Ruenkunye Apache Road. So really, we have given them a stadium in Rira. Recently, we have made Rira a city. What are they complaining of? He has been a member of parliament. I have never seen Jim Akena in parliament bringing the issues of his people. So how will the government know that there are some challenges in Oyam, there are some challenges in Irira, there are some challenges in Lango? When a member of parliament from that region, who dominates actually the region, because UPC dominates that region, cannot raise their issues on the floor of parliament.
So what should be the expectations of the people of Uganda moving forward, especially when these opposition parties are expressing concern about shrinking democratic space, human rights abuses, and the use of state institutions like the police and the judiciary to clamp down on the opposition?
I urge all Ugandans, now we are going to elections, wipe out all those hypocrites from the opposition. Because when we are in parliament, when times for increasing our allowances and salaries, we do it together. They never refuse. What have they ever refused from government? They would wink their voters, they would wink Ugandans that they are fighting for them. When they come to parliament, they are given huge committees, accountability committees, because they are the ones who are supposed to ask those government officials to account for our money. But if they cannot do that, then how do they expect us who do not sit in those committees to squeeze those people? Kindly, all Ugandans, vote out those hypocrites who claim to be in the opposition, yet when it comes to sharing the national cake, they share with us.
David Kabanda is a member of parliament from the ruling NRM. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. In Ethiopia, an author and political analyst says a conference in the capital Addis Ababa, held by critics and opponents of the Eritrea government, could increase tensions between the two neighboring countries. Emmanuel Biademarian, whose book is titled Eritrea, The Struggle is Long and Victory is Certain, says proponents of the meeting appear to be seeking international support for a government change in Eritrea, which he says is dangerous to regional peace and stability. His remarks come after a conference called the Blue Revolution Movement met in Ethiopian capital Addis Ababa. It attracted about 1,000 Eritreans in the diaspora who are opposed to Eritrean President Isaias Afewerki and his administration in Asmara. Proponents say they seek a constitutional rule where the people can choose their own leaders in a transparent democratic process. Emmanuel Biademariam tells me tensions could increase between Ethiopia and Eritrea and the Horn of Africa due to the aim of the Blue Revolution Movement meeting.
There are so many underlying facts. These are the people that are being called back to Ethiopia to convene and confer and organize and re-energize and strategize to execute whatever plans that they are planning to execute. And they're doing it in Ethiopia, and they're doing it publicly in the open. And that means that the government of Ethiopia is openly doing several things, saying that we are going to openly antagonize Eritreans, whatever objectives that they may have. So that is a blatant disregard for peace.
What do you think the ramification will be following this?
Well, the ramification is simple. First of all, the idea that it's okay to bring in anybody from a different country, an African country, openly recruiting and developing public enemies of the diaspora internally, militarily, in terms of Eritrean security, they're not going to be able to impact anything. But the only thing that they can do is they can go outside the country and defame Eritrea, do propaganda, and antagonize the Eritrean communities, weaken their resolve, on those kinds of things.
But you think this is aimed to tarnish the reputation of the government in Asmara abroad?
Oh, yeah, to tarnish the reputation of the government abroad, to change the narratives, to replace the Eritrean communities abroad, and lobby on their behalf with supporters that support regime change, that have regime change agendas in the West, whoever they may be. Are they going to be, they are the conduit, they are going to be the people that these people are going to use in order to pursue their anti-Eritrean agenda. So that's basically how that's going to work. But the ramifications as a whole for the region is now that the Eritreans can do the same thing. That means that that's going to help push Ethiopia to be destabilized.
Are you saying that for the meeting being held, it would increase tension not only between Asmara and Addis Ababa, but the entire Horn of Africa region?
It's going to put more pressure on Ethiopia. The Eritrean people, the Sudanese people, the Somali people, and the Egyptian people are united. Even South Sudanese, in fact, South Sudan and Sudan today agreed to mutually work together. And so Ethiopia is being isolated externally from the region, and it's going to get internal pressures from a lot of different directions. As it is, it's fractured. So the pressure is going to be on Ethiopia. So it could backfire.
From the regional perspective, what do you see happening about easing political tension in the Horn of Africa?
Outside from the conversation about this very development, I think the government of Eritrea is keen at stabilizing the region. In other words, we don't want to see Ethiopia fragmented and destabilized. We have an agreement with Somalia. We have an agreement with Egypt and Somalia, a tripartite agreement that is very comprehensive. Eritrea is supporting openly the Somali government. So is the Egyptian government. And so regionally, they are aligned. Sudan, the Eritrean government, what they've done is in terms of, the relationship between the people of Sudan and Eritrea now is totally changed. And so the odd man out is going to be Ethiopia. But originally, I think they want to see Ethiopia succeed. They want to see regional stabilization so we can work collectively together. That's in the interest of the region.
Emmanuel Biadi Mariam is an author and political analyst. He spoke with me from here in Washington. In Mozambique, opponents of the new administration say President Daniel Chapo should not ignore his main rival and opposition leader Venancio Mondlane. They urge the president to find time to engage with the opposition leader to ease the simmering political tensions in the country. But analysts say it is unclear if the president and the ruling party will agree to any engagement soon. They contend that the president appears to be busy with forming his government as part of his plan to keep his campaign promises before the elections. Sidia Chisungu is a Mozambican activist and political analyst. She tells me that citizens will benefit from peace and stability if the president meets the main opposition leader to address any concerns of those who did not vote for him may have to ensure his government is successful.
To be honest, I'm almost sure that it's going to take a time until Daniel Chapo starts really doing things because he thinks whatever the decision will be better to the country. Because right now, for example, even though Chapo was sworn in as the president, he's not yet the president of Frelimo. The elections will be on the 14th. And right now, we are seeing a Frelimo that we are used to, that they wait until the last consequence to start the dialogue. We have seen this before. When Diakama was alive, several times we had situations like this, that things had to go wrong until finally, for example, in 2015, Nyusi decided to go to Gorongosa to talk, 2015 or 16, to talk to Diakama. And he said something interesting. He said the decision for him to go to the bush in Gorongosa without saying anything to other members of the party is because he was sure that he wouldn't be allowed to do it. So now we understand the dynamics. So it's possible that Daniel Chap wants to meet Venancio, but within Frelimo, that's not a consensus.
Do you think meeting his rival will ease political tension, especially when the situation is relatively calm now?
I wouldn't say that. The situation is not calm. For example, just from Thursday last week, residents in Maputo have been resisting paying tolls because Venancio Mondlane said no one should be paying toll in his new decree with like 33rd measures. So we have in the capital city cars that cannot move, people that cannot go to work because people are blocking the tolls. I mentioned last week, Thursday, where even security forces got involved. On Monday as well, security forces got involved as well. And we have a case in Katembe where they even fired like tear gas inside of one of the cars trying to prevent protesters from blocking the streets. Just today, two people were shot in Casablanca, in Matola, in Manisa. Someone was shot. Not confirmed yet if it's dead or not. So we still have this high tension in Mozambique right now. We cannot say that the situation is calm because it's not calm.
So, Sidia, moving forward, what do you think is the best way to resolve the differences? Because Mondlane raised a series of issues about the elections. But moving forward, President Chapo has been installed officially. Where do the people of Mozambique go from here?
So basically, something very interesting that Venancio Mondlane has been saying, he doesn't even talk anymore about necessarily elections. He is talking, and also Mozambicans in general, they want to see a government that is really working for the people, and people see direct impacts of changes that happen in Mozambique. So even if we look at the 30 measures that Mondlane is talking about, of course, there are things that we can ignore, but there are things that make sense that people have to rethink. Just right now, the fact that Venancio Mondlane called the attention about how tolls in Mozambique are just draining money from Mozambicans, but in real life, it's very difficult to really say how Mozambicans are benefiting from it. Right now, people want to see the contracts and the agreements with Truck, and there are like with Truck. The South African company. And now people are finding out that they shouldn't be collecting money for the next 30 years because probably this money was paid already. But because there is lack of information, people are still digging. And we are sure that in the next few days, we will find out that there are many more things that probably shouldn't be happening. Right now, we have Mozambicans who are more, let's say, intentional about everything. Just a few days ago, so there is this competition, let's say, I forgot the exact name in English, to build like toilets. Right now, when people see the numbers, they want the truth, they have the money, they are asking. So I do think that there is no way people's demand can be ignored. So this is not about Venancio Mondlane anymore. If you ask what's the best solution to move forward, is to sit with Venancio Mondlane and listen what are the demands, because some of them make sense.
Sidia Chisungu is a Mozambican activist and political analyst. She spoke with me from the capital, Maputo. Still in Mozambique, President Daniel Chapo is naming his cabinet following his official installation as president of the Southern African country. But some critics say he is taking too long to assemble his government. They contend that the president needs to be swift in forming his administration to find solutions to the pressing economic challenges facing the country. Supporters of the ruling Frelimo party reject the criticism, saying President Chapo should ignore the negativity and focus on assembling the best team to help resolve the country's problems. For the latest political analysis, I reach out to Rodrigo Rocha. He is a lawyer and a political commentator in Mozambique.
First of all, I don't entirely agree that he's not moving fast enough. I would like to recall that even the previous governments, where there was no transition from the government, from an individual to another, on the second term from Mr. Gebuza, from the second term of Mr. Nyusi's presidency, it also took some time to get the complete government in force, in place. So what I believe that it's happening at this stage is that the current president, Mr. Daniel Chapo, is trying to analyze who has the best profile to manage the sectorial ministries under the current situations, and how to deliver and have the best policies delivered to the people as being promised during the electoral campaign, and after that in the subsequent messages and addresses that Mr. Chapo has made to the public.
There have been a series of minor protests with some people refusing to pay tolls because they said the main opposition leader or the rival of President Chapo is telling them not to pay the tolls.
That is not, in my view, a direct consequence of what the opposition leader is asking. In fact, there has been a lot of concerns on how the toll gates and the price of the toll gates are being charged to the to the general public, mainly because the when you pay a toll in a certain road, you expect a certain level of services being delivered, good quality of the asphalt, good visibility to the roads, and good assistance in case of any sort of hazards during the movement on those highways. And I believe that, and this is my opinion, that the protests are not because of any opposition demand, but actually during or because of the conscience that when you pay for the use of a certain road, of a certain highway, you should expect to have it in good conditions. The opposition leader, again, is trying to call for himself the initiative that is running genuinely and by the mere occasion of exercising their rights to protest, to call it as it being from his will, but it's not.
Calm, I understand, has been returned in a lot of parts of the country, but do you think the current situation paves the way for the president to begin implementing his policies of improving the lives of the people of Mozambique?
I tend to agree with the opinions that says yes. And the reason is that, as you know, the majority of the population in Mozambique, they live in the rural area, not in the seas, in the cities. So it's not very, how would I say, it's not very clear that once you have someone providing policies to the general population of Mozambique, if the population that lives in the city does not identify with those sorts of policies, doesn't mean that it's being taken against the people, but rather probably not in favor of a certain minority that is living in the cities. This is something that we need to bear in mind. Also, we need to understand that the majority of the population in Mozambique, they are young. It's a very young population. And the current ministers, they are very young. I believe this is the youngest government that Mozambique has ever seen since the first government after the independence. This means that I believe that the current government, being led by the current president, Mr. Daniel Chapo, they are in a good conditions to show that this is a total different type of government, even if it comes from the same ruling party.
Talking about the youngest assembly of government, some of his critics are saying it might not necessarily be accurate because none of the ministers he has named so far are below the age of 35 years old, so it's not young. And they are also saying that he has to engage the opposition leader moving forward in order to ensure that he carries along all the Mozambicans, even though some people did not vote for him. Your thoughts?
Well, let me go first for the age issue. First of all, I don't believe that fact that the ministers are not younger than 35 years old is an argument that you should use against or in favor of any government. I believe that meritocracy is what needs to be taken into account.
Rodrigo Rocha is a lawyer and a political commentator in Mozambique. Spoke with me from the Mozambican capital, Maputo. The chairperson of the Malawi Electoral Commission is calling for collective action from all stakeholders to ensure the coming elections are credible. Justice Annabel Ntalimanji made the call during the recent launch of the Civil Society Elections Integrity Forum. The platform is aimed to push for more transparency and accountability in the coming elections. Led by the National Advocacy Platform, the Elections Integrity Forum provides ways to confront election-related challenges, including misinformation and violence. It brings together all stakeholders to monitor the manifestos of the political parties while implementing mechanisms to ensure the campaigns focus on challenges facing the country. For more about the platform and its prospects, I reach Benedict Kondowe. He is the national chairman of the National Advocacy Platform.
So we had a very great moment during the launch because different stakeholders were invited to the launch, presided over by the very MEC chairperson, Honorable Justice Ntalimanja, who came in as a guest of honor. We also had representative from the Peace and Unity Commission. One of the commissioners was also represented, who also participated in the panel discussion. We also had representatives from political parties. So all in all, it was a very exciting moment that we launched the Civil Society Elections Integrity Forum. There's a lot of expectation from the launch and a lot of commitment as well from different stakeholders, including UNDP, that was represented by the advisor who came in on behalf of their resident representative.
During the launch, the chairperson of the Malawi Electoral Commission called for collective action to ensure transparent, inclusive, and credible elections. How important is this call?
This is very important because our view is that the electoral integrity is a byproduct of the contribution of different stakeholders. Make Malawi Electoral Commission on its own cannot secure electoral integrity. It requires all of our efforts, including that of political parties, to be accountable, to remain true, faithful, open to dialogue, engaging, and being sincere to respect and uphold the will of the people. So we took note of what the MEC chairperson had said and totally agreed on the premise that if we were to safeguard ensuring that every vote counts, every voice is held, then we need to collectively work together to safeguard the right to vote and ultimately the outcome of the 16th September 2025 elections.
The general election is just a little over 200 days away, and people are suggesting that the forum's establishment marks a pivotal moment in ensuring electoral integrity and safeguarding democracy. But how do you plan on moving the voter population or prospective voters along in order to actualize this objective of this platform?
What we would want to see is ensuring that we have a regular and structured system of engaging with MEC that is entrusted with the constitutional mandate to manage elections, in dealing with electoral disputes, in ensuring that all registered voters are afforded the opportunity to vote on the actual day. But most importantly, making sure that Malawians have access to information. So we'll be closely working with MEC and political stakeholders to make sure that there are no limitations when it comes to patronizing campaigns by different political parties. Because the political environment that we've had before the launch is to the effect that there has been political violence, most largely instigated by political parties. There have also been cases where some political parties have demarcated no-go zone for other political parties on the premise that they are strong in those places. Our view is that if that is sustained, it will stifle the right to vote. Because there are two fundamentals when it comes to the right to vote, in our view. Number one is the existence of security. You can only go and vote if you feel secure. Number two, you can write a vote for a candidate who would serve your needs if you have access to information. So where limitations to campaign are made, that would deprive the potential voters from accessing information that would help them to inform their decision in terms of who to vote for. So this is also an area that we'd want to work on. But most importantly, we'll be collaborating with the Peace and Unity Commission, the National Initiative for Civic Education, and the Center for Multi-Party Democracy in terms of strengthening the grassroots peace-building structures so that there is coexistence, there is a shared understanding that despite differing in opinion, we are all Malawians, and we have Malawi. The only country we have and we know is Malawi, and therefore we should all collectively protect it.
Benedicto Kondowe is the national chairman of the National Advocacy Platform. He spoke with me from the Malawian capital, Lilongwe. A lawyer for Niger's former president, Mohamed Bazoum, is calling on the military government to heed growing international calls for the release of the detained former leader. Reed Brody, a human rights lawyer, also expresses hope that the U.S. government will seek to have Bazoum released. This following reports that Marco Rubio, the new U.S. Secretary of State, plans to promote democracy around the world. His remarks come amid growing international calls for the release of the former democratically elected leader of Niger. Bazoum was overthrown by the military on July 26, 2023, and placed under house arrest. For more on the calls for the release of former President Bazoum, I reach his attorney, Reed Brody.
It's incredibly important that this democratically elected president, who has been rotting in jail for a year and a half, not be forgotten. A man who was focused on empowering girls, on reducing corruption, on bringing stability, and who was overthrown in a military coup in July 2023. He was removed from office and held, and is being held captive with his wife in two small rooms of his former palace. And his detention is a stark reminder of the challenges of the region to democracy.
Some people are suggesting that the case is symbolic for Niger and its people. What is your take?
I think, you know, this is so important. Under Bazoum's leadership, Niger built strong alliances with democratic allies around the world. He sought to protect Niger from extremist threats while working to create economic opportunities, increase educational access, especially for girls, and to uplift marginalized communities. All of that came to an end in July 2023 when the military, which were about to lose control over the petroleum sector, which President Bazoum was going to put on a fair and transparent footing, overthrew him in a coup, and has been ruling the country ever since. The military was supposed to bring stability. It has brought, in fact, much more terrorism in the country. It was supposed to bring economic stability. In fact, all the indicators suggest that poverty is up in Niger. And the question is, are we going to forget about this man? There has been no trial. I'm one of his lawyers. I was able to speak to him for the first few months of his detention by phone, and then they took his phone away. He and his wife are cut off from the rest of their family, from their friends, from their lawyer. He gets a doctor's visit two times a week who brings him food and medicine, and that is it.
The new U.S. Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, is reported to have said that he intends to promote democracy worldwide. Do you think this will have an impact on the case of Bazoum?
Well, that's we certainly hope so. I mean, that's one of the hopes of this campaign, is that the new administration, particularly with Marco Rubio's commitment to democratic governments around the world, will look at this brave Democrat, elected president, rotting in jail, and say, this is the kind of man who we need to be dealing with. This is not the kind of person who should be in jail. We have rulings from the regional court, the ECOWAS Court of Justice, that says that his detention is arbitrary and that he should be freed. We have a case pending before the UN Working Group on Arbitrary Detention, which we hope will rule in the same direction. The High Commissioner for Human Rights, the United Nations Secretary General have all called for his release, as has the United States. But these calls have become sparse and ritualistic. Now it's time for action. Now it's time to get this committed Democrat, this friend of the West, out of jail.
Reed, what do you think are the prospects and calls in the international community for Mohamed Bazoum to be released? What do you think the prospects are?
Well, I think we've seen people, and not just in the West, but we heard the outgoing president of Ghana, Nana Akufo-Addo, call for his release. We've seen a number of statesmen and leaders from around the world. The head of the UN, former head of UNDP, Helen Clark, the president, former presidents of Bosnia, of the Czech Republic, of Albania, of Croatia, calling recently for his release. 1,000 people have just signed a petition in Washington calling for his release. Nobel Peace Prize winners calling for his release. We hope that this chorus will convince people that this is a man, and that we hope, obviously, that countries that have influence on the junta in Niger, the African Union President Hoswani of Mauritania has been very active in pushing for President Bazoum's release. We hope that the junta in Nigeria is going to hear those calls and let him go.
Reed Brody is a lawyer for Niger's former President Mohamed Bazoum. He spoke with me from Barcelona, Spain. The leaders of the Niger coup said they acted to bolster the country's security and economy. They also opposed the continued French security presence in the country. French troops left the country in late 2023. In Cameroon, chiefs and traditional rulers have endorsed incumbent President Paul Biya to seek re-election. It comes as opposition and critics of the administration say the 91-year-old longtime leader is too old and may not have the energy to effectively administer the affairs of the country. The governing Cameroon People's Democratic Movement, or CPDM, plans to maintain the president as its candidate in the coming general election. This as the Speaker of Parliament called for a Catholic bishop to be punished for calling on Cameroonians to change the country's leader. For the latest political development, I reach Michael Indimancho. He is a political analyst based in the Cameroonian commercial capital, Douala.
You know, one of the first things that Paul Biya did was to go around all the 10 regions in Cameroon to take power from the chiefs. And in all of these regions, it means that what? Paul Biya is above all of them. Paul Biya is the one who commands all the chiefs and the pawns and the traditional leaders. Paul Biya is like their boss. And actually, they are being reminded of those powers that they gave him in the 1980s. And you must know that the chiefs now have gone out of their traditional calling, and most of the chiefs are now in the administration. And in Cameroon, there's an adage that a mouth that eats doesn't talk. And the chiefs have adopted that statement. Secondly, the chiefs have been classified and they're on salaries. So we have the first class chief, which receives a particular amount of salary, second class and third class. And that is what is happening. And there is this policy that any chief that does not align with the policies of the ruling party will not receive any pleasantries from the head of state.
A priest has come out to say that Cameroon needs change and that even if the devil comes, it will be better than the status quo. He has come under withering criticism. How are people reacting to this on the ground?
Okay, now, you see, the priest, when that Catholic Bishop of Yagua, the Diocese of Yagua, he talked about that. And there was a lot of agitations. Let me remind you, immediately after that statement, there were some ministers, top government officials who came out to criticize him. But let me tell you, it was like a kind of the voice of the voiceless from Cameroon, because a lot of the popular people, the citizens of Cameroon, praised that outfit. But the government officials, they had to come out to criticize him. You know, one of the persons who criticized him was the president of the National Assembly, Lampoon or Lambas, the Bishop of Yagua, and even asked that the Pope convoke the Bishop of Yagua for that statement. After that statement from the Bishop of Yagua, the Diocese of Yagua, the Minister of Communication came out with a statement to say that Mr. President Pobia has not declared his intention to go for the next presidential election, and therefore he doesn't know why the prelates and the bishop and all other people are agitating. So now we are also expecting that after the pronouncement of the chiefs and the traditional rulers, the same minister should come out and sit tell them and remind them that even though they are calling for the president to run for the next presidential election, the president has not declared his intention. We were expecting this.
People are suggesting that the opposition is also very weak. A lot of opposition political parties, they are not united, they are divided, which they said makes it effectively simple for the CPDM, in this case, President Paul Biya, to continue to win elections in Cameroon. Briefly, your thoughts.
My thought is that the opposition is weak because of the divide and rule strategy of the ruling party. Let me tell you. And to remind you, right in Cameroon, we have a total of 371 political parties. That is opposition parties. Immediately, the opposition wants to come together in a concerted action. There is always this tearing of the storm in the teacup that prevents the opposition to come out with a concerted action to fight the regime in place. This is what has been happening. You have heard about the past attempts for the opposition to come together, whereby there is the APC, the FCC, the MRC, the Cameroon Resistance Movement, and all that came together, and then the Minister of Communication would come out and shatter all the plans. You have heard about the leading political parties in Cameroon, like the Cameroon Resistance Party, that is being barred from running from the election, the next the coming election. You have heard about the Perse RNA Party. I mean, one of the parties run by who is a member of parliament, whereby now you find they're creating that kind of disorder between him and the founder of the party. And now it appears as if the party is being run by two people. So there is this deliberate and premeditated attempt to shatter the opposition anytime the opposition wants to come together.
Michael Ndimancho is a political analyst. He spoke with me from the Cameroonian commercial capital, Douala. Climate change is making it harder for African farmers to grow the continent's staple crop, maize. But food activists in South Africa say a return to traditional diets could help. Reporting from Johannesburg, Zahir Kasim explores the benefits of sorghum and why this indigenous African grain is disappearing from grocery shelves.
Sorghum has long been a dietary staple across Africa. The grain is native to the continent. It requires less water than maize and is packed with vitamins, minerals, fiber, antioxidants, and protein, earning it the type of a superfood. Still, South African farmers produce about 80% less sorghum than they did 30 years ago, official data shows. Sipiwe Sithole is an author and farmer.
When you look into the pros and cons on sorghum, we should be growing sorghum because the small-scale farmers, if you think about how many smallholder farmers we have in this country, if they were to all to grow, or majority of them were to grow, we would have enough sorghum in this country.
Food activist and chef Mukhadi Etsweng is calling for a return to traditional diets, including sorghum.
We have a connection with sorghum that is spiritual. So if we had to go back to all eating sorghum, no one's going to eat the maize. No one's going to want, because maize is also not sustainable.
Maize is South Africa's primary staple food and its most widely grown crop, according to government data. But severe weather linked to last year's El Nino pushed up maize prices across much of Southern Africa. Sorghum is far more drought tolerant and can grow on less fertile land. But sorghum production takes up more space and is more labor-intensive and costly to grow, say experts. Today, sorghum is found mostly in wealthy areas and is billed as a premium product. Economists say farmers see a limited market for it. Wandile Sihlobo is the chief economist of the Agricultural Business Chamber of South Africa.
The decisions are made by the farmers on the basis of the profitability. And in fact, if you talk to food processors, they likely want to process sorghum and put it out in the market, but they are just not seeing the mass demand for it.
Food activists say boosting demand for sorghum could spark more production and reduce costs, making this superfood a viable alternative to maize. Seri Kasim, VOA News, Johannesburg, South Africa.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, right now it's time for music from our African collection.
Chamina dua I send ya kilini moyoni bado we wanizuzua. When are you coming home, Senje? Tell me, are you on your way? Kife tukipendana Kiromeo na Julia. I send ya nakosa usingizi usiku kuchamina dua. I send ya kilini moyoni bado we wanizuzua. When are you coming home, Senje? Tell me, are you on your way? Tukipendana Kiromeo na Julia I send a banesenje.
Hello, hello, hello,
hello, hello.
If you get to hear this song,
Senje, come on.
Somebody loves you.
shimmy. Ajay, I call me, I call me. Ah, Odre, Jamie, see, ha. Sanya, you need, ha. Oh, I shock, I just can't believe it. My heart broken up in pieces. Time will heal my wounds. Until then, I pick up and go. Ajay, don't know what to do, I feel so confused. Ah, thinking it's a dream, it's like deja vu. I can't believe you did this to me. Samantha, I catch you. Say, baby, now my Odo, you woo, missy, fat you. After all you've done to me, you want to drink one, eh, gummyo. Missy Hana, miss me, moo. Odo, catch you. Fat you. Odo, catch you.
Was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. From the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Kwame Ofori, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, noise and hunting don't go together. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.